Those are the best.
Do you think that as we get to Havana and we learn more and we experience more of the Supreme, do you think that this is a necessary attribute for us to recognize some unity of deity before we can ever recognize the Universal Father?
Mm-hmm. Especially on the sixth Havana circuit, where we're under the tutelage of the supremacy guides, and where the authors of the papers say we deduce the unseen action of the Supreme Being by what happens to pilgrims going through the sixth Havana circuit. Here is where they achieve their pre-paradise comprehension of the unity of deity. And if you'll
because
recall,
in the eternal sun, we won't get that unity.
The let me read you a paragraph from there. It's rather beautiful. I'm somewhat at a loss to explain what takes place on this circle. No personalized presence of supremacy is perceptible to the ascenders. But regardless of our inability to grasp the technique, each ascending creature seems to undergo a transforming growth, a new integration of consciousness, a new spiritualization of purpose, a new sensitivity for divinity, which can hardly be satisfactorily explained without assuming the unrevealed activity of the Supreme Being. To those of us who have observed these mysterious transactions, it appears as if God the Supreme were affectionately bestowing upon his experiential children, up to the very limits of their experiential capacities, those enhancements of intellectual grasp, of spiritual insight, and of personality outreach, which they will so need in all their efforts at penetrating the divinity level of the Trinity of Supremacy to achieve the eternal and existential deities of paradise. Isn't that a beautiful statement?
What page is that?
292. Here on this Havana circuit, the ascenders come near to encountering the central universe source of time-space unity. Yeah, he's for us. We're part of his growth, and he's a part of our growth. And this is where he puts in his final legs. He's doing everything he can for us. Like a good coach.
It's gonna be the difference.
By then we will have comprehended so many different lifespans that we don't visualize now yet. It's altogether different pictures of this plain life to me.
That experience must feel you to pretty close to busting, you know it. Yeah. Well, you can't miss it because we each have got the best guide in the world. Yeah.
Well, Bill, you want to come back to your answer for a minute?
Yeah, we've been a long ways away.
A question. What can we do? What can some group do, or what can some leader do? In analyzing the frustrations of our American people, don't you think if they knew from whence they came and where they were cosmically and time-wise and were advised of a potential destiny, that a hell of a lot of the unrest and frustration would disappear?
Sure it would, Clyde.
What can we do about it? What can we as mortals do about it?
There was a sower who went forth to sow.
But I want to tell
you. So said Jesus 1900 years ago to the 12. That's all we can do.
Well, why did Bert stick his fingers up like a pheromone?
Antenna.
That's
there
all we can do, Clyde.
To receive.
Yeah, that's all we can do. You can't go out and beat people over the head with this book. All you can do is sow seeds. And wait. And here you've got to be patient. And this is not being lackadaisical. It takes time for seeds to sprout. And if I knew where to sow more seeds, I'd go sow them. I'm doing the best I can, Clyde, with what I've got. And that's all any of us can do.
And injustice in mind.
No. But you've got to do it with wisdom. A wise sower is going to get a better crop than a stupid one. Now, I don't believe in sitting quietly and oozing righteousness and waiting for people to catch my fragrance when they happen to be downwind from me. I don't mean to be sarcastic, but some such statements have been made at one time or another. But neither do I think you can get yourself a reverse English threshing machine and load it up with seeds and fire them like bullets all over the countryside. That's the other side of the coin. What can you do where you are, as you are? You're only one man, but you are one man. You can't transcend the limitations of your time, your place, your station, your resources. And between doing nothing and contemplating you could paint three circles on your navel and go through it, see? And between just sitting quietly and oozing righteousness and being frenzied is a common sense middle of the road. Which is neither lackadaisical, nor is it incompatible with wisdom. You've got your health to take care of, you've got your job to do in the world, your duty to discharge, and then, if it be in your heart, comes this book. And after that come the trifles of life. But there are two things that come ahead of this book.
That's right. But now the book starts to weigh on me. Not weigh, but I mean, I got some hounds. And,
Clyde, do this.
Get your antenna down. They look like horns, birds.
Clyde, I try to operate like a greedy fisherman, not a frenzied fisherman. If I think there's fish in a pool, I go casting. In the meantime, I got a troll line out. I'm always dropping odds and ends, you know. And if I get a nibble, I'll act on it pretty fast. But if I think there's a prospect over there, I'll actively cast, you know. And between casting and the troll line, I don't know what else to do.
Now, there is the difference. There's the difference. Between just having your antenna. You're actively out.
But I only cast if I have reason to suspect.
got to pick up something first.
Yeah. Now, I'll make a cast. Example, I made a deliberate cast in the family of Sandy and Helena Wall in Connecticut. I thought about this. I didn't make my cast until mid-1957. The book was out almost 2 years. Why did I delay? I delayed until I felt my friendship with this couple was strong enough to stand the strain that I was going to put on it when I sent this book there. And when in my judgment, that friendship had matured, it ripened over a period of 2 years, I sent the book. I just wrote Sandy a cryptic letter. I'd sent him other books. I said, I'm asking our bookseller to send you a book that I think you'll enjoy. Best regards to Helene and the kids. I didn't name it. And of course, the letter got there ahead of the book. Helene was in California with the kids. I didn't know that. And Sandy's buddy, Bruni, who sells for Cannon Towels. He's a product sales manager. They opened the book, looked it over, and decided I'd slip my wig. Yeah. They kidded me about it afterwards. They said they agreed with each other that they should greet me in very modulated, pear-shaped tones and not excite me in any way. And Sandy wrote me a cryptic letter and said, when do you plan to come to Connecticut? And we went, I visited them. I got up there on a Saturday morning. I never mentioned a thing about the book. And finally, after an hour and a half, Sandy says, well, this delay has gone on long enough. Now come out here, you, and tell us about this blue book. And my friendship stood the strain. We spent that weekend. Now, I didn't cast until I was waiting until I had a strong enough bond between us that in my judgment it would stand the stress. I didn't want to lose Sandy as a friend. I have another equally good friend who runs Toledo Scales. He's a brilliant engineer. I gave Dick a book. I'd known Dick for 6 years at the time. I didn't think Dick was as good a prospect, and I sure was right. He's just not interested in religion. And I've never let his disinterest in the least impair our friendship. This man is my friend regardless.
He's not receptive.
He just isn't receptive.
Bill, what people's names is speaking right now? He's wiped out his cancer last year up in Chicago.
Tom Witterow.
Well, now the Witterows did the same thing to Major Wilson.
Uh-huh.
3 years before they ever let her have the book. They, not the book, but, you know, they were going through the papers up there.
Uh-huh.
And they, when they were being together, they would mention things about them. When the book came out, she was ready.
I stir up my pal Dick. Philosophically, he'll respond on the philosophic level. I've got him interested in what is really real. When you cut through attitude, prejudice, parochialism, provincialism, emotionality, what's real? This intrigues Dick. That's as far as I can go, and I don't push my luck any farther.
Talking about philosophy, due to what circumstances was Socrates, finally convicted and put to death?
He got out of tune with the Mores of Athens, with their customs.
I mean, he got out of tune?
With the customs of Athens.
Well, wasn't he digging into what is reality?
Yeah.
He was thinking.
Yeah, but he was antagonistic. Socrates, he was seek out a man to find out what the man was brilliant on. Mm-hmm. Then he'd try to prove that the man was wrong in some aspect. He wanted to impose his intelligence on him.
Mm-hmm.
And make the man look small, and they didn't like that.
He wasn't.
Got to where nobody would listen to him.
He wasn't constructive.
No.
He wasn't constructive.
Evidently not. He didn't fit.
He takes something
away. He wanted to impose his point of view on everybody, whether citizen or not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was, no doubt, motivated by some urge.
Maybe he had too much ego.
He was a brilliant man. But he didn't use it wisely.
When you try to impose your theology on another man, that's ego. Motivation, not truth motivation. Way down deep.
That's
when you come right down.
You're going to kill friends and you're not going to impose them.
No.
Theologically, but philosophically,
no.
You can
discuss. Well, we overlap there. In terms of psychological testing, Dick has a high theoretical motivation and a low religious motivation. He has curiosity, but he's not interested in religion. He asks me about this book now and then. But we talk about other things. It's good talk, too. He's a nice guy to talk with. I like him.
Thank you.
were you going to talk about?
It was you.
What do you mean?
Yes, at the dinner table you said you'd like him to talk on.
Well, I had him talk on fact and truth and facts, and that's somebody else's turn.
Oh, that's right. He finished up what he wanted to talk on. I guess. I don't know if he finished up or not fast.
Well, I promised you I'd bring him time to get home. I forgot.
Oh, well,
oh.
Because While there is a technical divergence between thing and value, they're almost indistinguishable. When you take your ammeter, voltmeter, and plug it into the Isle of Paradise, you get a certain registry. And if you can find some spiritual conduit and plug it in there, same ammeter, voltmeter, you get the same kind of a registry. The energy of the aisle and the energy of the sun are indistinguishable, except by name, which means when it comes from the sun, you call it Paradise Spirit. When it comes from the aisle, you call it Paradise Monota. But that's the only difference it has. You name it differently. You cannot measure any difference between the two. You're too close to God. Thing and value are about to converge, and just before they converge, they're indistinguishable. So mind on Paradise, while it has a function, does not have the function that we associate with mind out here. A mediator between matter and spirit. In Havona, mind does have that function, and it performs it perfectly. Matter and spirit in Havona are perfectly synchronous. There's no conflict between the movements of the physical universe of Havona and the spiritual purposes of its personal inhabitants. Come with me to your rancher. It's a different story out here. Man can have all kinds of virtue in his life. The elements know it not. Hurricane Carla killed some people. I don't think they were wicked or evil. Well, I think they were there. That's all. When the hurricane passed over. I don't think those who survived were necessarily good, and those who were killed were necessarily bad. I don't see much connection in the day-by-day happenings of this world between spirit and matter. I see mind acting on matter and exhibiting its dominance, its control over things material, through science, through discovery, through machines, through processes. Little by little, man is really whipping the socks off this planet, if he doesn't whip himself first. Mind, we're told, operates in 3 degrees of affiliation. At one extreme, it's dominated by the mechanicalness of matter. It's even referred to as mechanical mind, non-teachable mind, pre-adjutant mind. Very dependable mind. A sunflower just does not miss turning towards the sun. And that is mind action of a certain very low level. The mind of a Frandelank is completely dependable. It's dominated by the machinery of the Frandelank, the living machinery of the Frandelank. Now at the other extreme, we have mind affiliated with spirit. It's completely dependable, completely non-mechanical, utterly free. It's free because it's loyal. It's ethical. It's fraternal. It has imposed upon itself many obligations to other people so it can achieve freedom. But then we've got mind in transit. Mind in transit from thing dominance to spirit affiliation. And here's where mind runs the risk of falling in love with itself, especially personal mind. Because the only mind we know anything about, or the only mind we experience, his mind with freedom of choice. Consider a planet and consider how valuable are all the restrictions that are put upon its primitive inhabitants. They don't have much time to get into mischief, do they? They're busy eking out a living, and I mean eke. Winter is a perilous time. You don't have much reserves in the way of personal fat or food in the larder. I'll bet you the natives are pretty skinny come springtime, look like bears after hibernation. It had been slim pickings all winter. These people are so busy doing what they have to do to stay alive. There isn't much time for evil, sin, iniquity, or so on. In the age of light and life, when they work a half an hour a day, they don't have much problems. They're pretty well settled that they're going to embark on the quest for God. It's in these in-between ages that we can run into trouble. We've got a surplus. We aren't in danger of starvation. If we're hungry, we can always move to Corsicana, Texas, because the free handout of groceries has gotten into meat and black-eyed peas, and some pretty nice provisions they're handing out down there. Supermarket sales are down, but candy and pop sales are up. They're having trouble hiring field hands, too. Remember, of course, Ken. We can get into trouble because we have achieved leisure without having those ethics, that morality, and that spirituality which would keep us from translating liberty into license. We can be wasters with our leisure, or producers with our leisure. We have to live inside of mind. Man's adventure in this life is pretty much an adventure in his own consciousness, as he reacts to outside stimuli coming in over his sensory mechanism, makes decisions. The real human being, civilization really lives in the inner life of civilized human beings. You take that inner life away and civilization quickly vanishes. You augment that inner life and it quickly shines forth in the artifacts of civilization. All beautiful buildings, all beautiful music, all curricula in teaching, all new discoveries are born in the inner life of man. And by and large, this life is emotional on one end, spiritual maybe a little bit on the other, but pretty intellectual in between. Here is where man moves and lives and has his being. Here is where God dwells also in man, in mind. Mind is what you can really mold. You can't do a heck of a lot directly about your soul. You sort of feel you have one. But did you ever try to get a hold of it? It's slippery than a greased pig. It's in there, all right. I know it's there. But I can't get a hold of it. Can any of you folks? If you can, I'm going to leave. But you know mine, don't you? This there is no doubt about it. who was it said, I think, therefore I am. It's a pretty good argument for reality. I know, therefore I am. This is the tool that's been given you to work with. It's in mind that personality has set up the great big red button of decision. It's not there for good. If you survive, personality will set that red button up in the surviving soul, which goes on after this life. In this life, though, the soul does not make decisions which have personality status. The decisions which personality consciously makes are made in the conscious arena of material mind. Please note that the papers speak of our mind as material mind, not mind. It's interesting to note, too, there are no creatures of pure mind. There are creatures of pure spirit. They don't have mind at all. Spirit doesn't have to have mind to be conscious. If it did, then neither the Father nor the Son would be conscious, because neither the Father nor the Son have mind. They're pre-mind deities. They think in a way that we could best understand if we tried to imagine how an adjuster thinks, because an adjuster doesn't have mind. Reflectivity won't pick up the consciousness of an adjuster because there is no mindful consciousness there to register. It'll register the adjuster as a divine entity, but they can't tell what an adjuster's thinking about because there is no think juice inside of an adjuster. And if there were reflectivity, it'd pick it up. You don't have to add mind to spirit, which shows the primacy of both the Father and the Son in relation to the third source. But spirit alone is not personal. You can add personality to spirit and change it in quality, showing the primacy of the Father in relation to the Son. That statement is not made in just that way, but I bootlegged it out of the 16 descriptions of personality.
I bet it's all in
there. The mind is the most flexible instrument we know. In mind, we partially escape from both time and space, from here and now. Can you reminisce? Certainly you can. Can you forecast? Certainly you can. Man's mind is something more than mind, because it knows itself. We're told in these papers that an animal knows, but is unaware of this fact. We know, and we are aware of this fact. Therefore, mind is not alone. There is something there before which mind can stand, as before a mirror, and see itself. Thus becoming aware of its own reality, or becoming conscious of its own consciousness. I think that something is an attribute of personality. I think personal minds are self-knowing minds. This mind we have is equipped with an instrument board. Since it's personal mind, it's got three compasses. One of them points towards mathematics. One of them points towards moral duty. And one of them points Godward in the direction of worship. These are the inalienables of mind, which the papers speak of in paper 16. The mathematical intuition of mind. The moral intuition of mind. The worshipful outreach of mind. And as they say, these are constitutive in human mind, hence, the evidence of these intuitions appears in every civilization, because civilization is the child of mind. Every civilization has its science, perfect or imperfect. One of the ways you can measure the development of science and civilization is to chase around the numerical value of pi. How good did they get at figuring out areas of circles? To how many places did they carry pi? That's one little criteria of scientific development. You can chase it through Chinese civilization, Egyptian civilization, Sumeric, and so on. All we got to do is be able to read their writing, because they were all puzzled by circles. The irrational number pi. Every civilization has its courts, its techniques of the administration of justice and its ideals of justice. And every civilization has built its churches and temples and places of worship. The civilization may crash, but these intuitions do not die out of human mind. And when civilization is born again, the institutions reflecting these intuitions again reappear in the new civilization. Mind, I think, is plastic. I think human beings can warp their minds. I think they can unwarp them if they don't stay warped too long. Mind is elastic, and like rubber, I think it discloses elastic fatigue or metallic fatigue. I think if you warp mind, that is to say, you depart somewhat from relative sanity. I think you run the danger of retaining that warp so long that you can't unwarp it. How do we warp mind? Danger of retaining that warp so long that you can't unwarp it. How do we warp mind? We rationalize. We find good reasons for doing bad things. We alibi to ourselves. We do a con job internally. We do a snow job, maybe even a blizzard job internally. We depart from sanity to that extent. We warp the world into that fable which justifies us. This is a departure from fact and truth, both. We warp our minds by projection. It's probably the worst thing we do. We criticize our own faults, most particularly and vehemently, when we find them in our fellow men. We know we should be critical of these faults, but we're much too tender of our own selves. And so we take it out on our neighbor when he has the same fault. We equivocate. We procrastinate. We seek ease. We're unfair. We avoid problems. In other words, we're mammalian. In our sloth. In our lethargy. And it's a good thing that we have things which prod us, which whip us, which cause us at least to be human, in part, if not spiritual. At least that's some progress over being mammalian. We seem to do our best thinking under stress. Wisdom appears to be inseparable from tribulation. Man is at his most beautiful in a stressed situation. We've used this illustration before. You're an artist, and you have a time machine, and you can go back in time, and we'll give you some fanciful armor so you don't have to worry about getting hurt. You can just concentrate on being an observer. You're going back into the pre-pluvial period in Europe. The Andites have yet to arrive. It's the heyday of the Cro-Magnons. It's been bad hunting along the Somme River. And you've spotted your quarry. You're going to take a color photograph as a background for the painting that you're going to make. You've got a magnificent specimen of a Cro-Magnon. He's about 20% Adamite. Almost as much as Burke. And this guy hasn't eaten regularly for a month. And he hasn't eaten anything for 3 days. And he's crouched on an overhanging limb. He's got a spear. Something is coming down through this trail. Probably a deer. That man is a poem of concentration. He's pretty skinny, and every muscle in his body is mobilized for the cast of that spear. This is a fit subject for me. You go flitting down another 10 years and you come back to the same glade. It's now 3.5 hours later. Our Cro-Magnon is lying on the turf. His belly is distended, gorged with barely cooked red meat. His mouth is open. He's snoring. There's some slobber on his chin, and the flies are buzzing around his face. Now, which picture would you take? Just for kicks, you take another color photo, because it's the end of the sequence. I know where we'd rather be, since we're ease-seeking, problem-avoiding, procrastinating, equivocating, unfair types, fellow citizens of the human race. We'd rather have our bellies full, wouldn't we? But where does man achieve beauty? He achieves beauty when he's confronted with a problem and he's operating under stress. Now, if there's any correlation between truth and goodness on the one hand and beauty on the other, can't you see why they forge out civilization between the anvils of anguish and the hammers of suffering? People are more beautiful when they have problems. Not happier, but they're finer.
You know, Brian.
What?
Their spirits are more beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm pretty sure the Cro-Magnon's body is more inspiring of aesthetics when he's got a problem than when he's belly is full.
We are showing our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Our problem is what to do with mind. We have some equipment in here, specifically personality, that has possibly quasi-absolute, co-absolute potentials. If you've got all that equipment, you could fall in love with it. It's amazing equipment. Of course, the fact that everybody else has got it should admonish you that this is, you're not exactly unique in the universe. But you can fall in love with this equipment. Lucifer did. And he's smarter than we are. Your human IQs are pretty good at 120, 125. What do you suppose Lucifer's IQ is? 400, 500, 600? I'm sure this is distinctly superhuman intelligence. And I don't think people run above 200. And then not much earthly use above 160 or 70. Lucifer fell in love with himself. Calcasti fell in love with himself. There is the ultimate danger in giving creatures this type of equipment. But it's the only way God can get sons. He's got to run this risk. He's got to give them personality. Or they wouldn't be his children. And while personality can operate creatively in the arena of mind, personality can also operate destructively in the arena of mind. And I think if we depart too far from sanity, which is another way of saying we embrace sin, I don't think we can find our way back again. And this is when sin translates to iniquity. And when our course becomes irreversible. We operate on a reversible course until we pass beyond the point of no return. This can also be a good passage. When you make a final decision, then regardless of your status, regardless of your imperfection, this thing is settled now. You have made an irreversible choice for God. And then it's just a matter of time until you meet God. And in the light of eternity, even a large amount of time does not have undue significance in the light of eternity. Mind is not spirit and it's not matter. It's a third reality. It is seemingly the most active reality out here in the evolutionary cosmos. It mediates matter and spirit. It is the technique whereby spirit can dominate matter if personality so wills. Because mind will whip matter always in the long run. And if it's personal mind, then the choosing personality can choose to subject that victorious mind to spirit affiliation. And then you've got an unbeatable combination. Now you're beginning to produce cosmos out of chaos. Now instead of handfuls of beads, you've got necklaces. The beads are in order. mind is a great tool, but it's not an end. If we take mind as an end, then we set up as an ideal a cold intellectuality. Jesus had a great intellect, but he was a warm person. Mind, per se, was not an end to Jesus. This book is not written primarily to illuminate the human mind. That's its secondary objective. Its primary objective is the salvation of the human soul. The illumination of the mind is second only to that primary objective. But it's the secondary objective, not the primary. Mind all by itself is repulsive. Who likes a cold intellect? Anybody? You might admire a cold intellectual. His serene solution of problems, his clever manipulation of language. But here you're looking at truth without the associated beauty and goodness. I don't think you'd like that guy as a bunkie. You know? Might be interesting to hear him lecture, or perform would be more the word. But a trained seal is interesting too. But if this mind has got some warmth and affection in it, then it becomes attractive and beautiful too, doesn't it? This then becomes an exciting person. Jesus was an exciting person to come in contact with. Jesus was fun. The kids liked it. Uncle Joshua come out and tell us a big story, said the little ones. He didn't repel them. He told them good stories. And he was a consummately good actor, I think. I bet his face got all worked over as he took different parts in different stories. In Jesus, you see mind well adjusted to the realities of life and well affiliated with spirit direction. Jesus just didn't work for Zebedee. He worked out a new method of boat building. And it was very competitive. Within a few years, it had driven all the other style boats off the Lake of Galilee. It was a better boat. When he started building boats, he thought. And as he thought, he invented. And as he invented, he improved. It was a better method of steaming the boards to warp them into shape. Jesus was a student, but he was not an austere professor like those who taught at the University in Alexandria, where Galen said, teacher, they've become confused by too much thinking. In Jesus, you see mind in harness to spirit. Jesus never browbeat anybody. He always made mind the servant of a constructive life, of doing good to his fellow men. He talked simply to the simple-minded. And he talked like a philosopher in Athens when the Greek said, at last my eyes have seen and my ears have heard a Hebrew who can talk something besides theology and believe something besides racial superiority. But he didn't lecture the two prostitutes, did he? He lectured Gainan for being short with him. And when Andrew said, shall I wake up the twins that night in Phelps's garden? He grinned. He says, no, Andrew. Let them sleep. They do very well. Are we about out, Bert? And as you see mind in the life of Jesus, you see a giant intellect subordinated to love. And there was nothing about Jesus' intelligence which frightened people. and he could talk about time and space and the soul and mind, and on and on. Yet he could be friends with simple-minded people. And yet he could be pretty indignant, too, when bright people took advantage of less bright people. Just as when stronger people take advantage of weaker people. Mind is what we've got to work with. And pretty much of our life, our real life, our inner life, is lived within the confines of mind. And I think as we reach spirit word, God word, adjuster word, we stabilize mind. We achieve a greater measure of sanity. We avoid we lift some of the cloud that obscures our view of reality. I think we can rationalize less, project less, alibi less, be less unfair, unkind, be less fence straddling, you know? You may have a little more, but I don't, Bert.
Yeah.
And my main proposition was that the last completely sane person on Earth died about 1900 years ago, and that all of us were insane to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're relatively insane. How can you strip your attitudes, your opinions, your convictions of their illusions? Illusion to me, to be a disillusioned human being is to be more sane. Because the illusion obscures your vision of reality. But to do this, you've got to have a great deal of courage. You've got to be able to stand up and accuse yourself even of dishonesty in thinking. Because much of our thinking is a technique of self-justification. If you're in dire straits, the tendency is to hate your creditors. And yet, they're the people who liked you well enough to give you credit. And of course, if you act emotionally, you'll disclose this fact, and soon your creditors will hate you. I remember many years ago, I was confronted with just plain disaster financially. Just that simple. There just wasn't anywhere near enough money. And my first reaction was resentment of my creditors. And I said, now wait a minute. That's emotional. Instead of that, doing what you normally do, I sat down and wrote each of them a letter. I enclosed a microscopic check and told them what I proposed to do about my dilemma. And I still remember the Greek grocer in the neighborhood. I went in there and he put his arm around me. He says, "Kid, don't worry, I carry you a year," he says.
Kid?
Yeah. "Don't worry, I carry you a year." This guy liked me. Instead, I got the nicest bunch of letters back from the butcher, the baker, the cat. It made my credit. I think I established my credit in the community out of that incident. Each month they got a very small check. Damn small for a while. But isn't that human? You're in a jam, so you hate the people you owe money to. And how illogical. They were your friends.
Huh? They never forget.
Yeah.
That's
right.
And that is true of so many people that are in dire financial straits that need help and
Yes, this is true.
I have about decided that the safest way in the world to help people is helping school organizations like these.
Oh, yeah.
Salvation Army.
Sure.
Individuals are turned on.
Negative.
They resent the fact that they are in a position to
accept
from you.
Facts of the matter are we're all ambivalent, which is a fancy word which means this. We love and we hate at the same time. We recognize that this is inconsistent. So we suppress one or the other in an effort to be consistent. And this is why when spouses, otherwise happily married, get into a little swivet, the tendency is for all of this suppressed stuff to come out. And another thing, and what's more, and, you know, you don't mind my waving my finger, JP.
No. That was a friendly wave.
Now,
can I repeat the bill?
Yeah. But this is human. This is human. And if we admit our weaknesses to ourselves, we've got a better chance to enhance our sanity. If we admit all of the bad in human nature to ourselves, and I don't mean wear a hair shirt and go around with a long face. This is perfectly consistent with having a good bottle of beer and laughing at a joke. But you just say, all right, so I'm mammalian. And this is the way animals are. My problem is not to beat my breast and say mea culpa. My problem is, all right, let's keep growing away from this towards being more human. And after I get to be completely human, which I think is about where you are on Jerusalem, then I think you can start in to try to be superhuman. The gods don't look down on us for being animals. They planned it this way. They planned it this way. Mind's all we got that we can handle for sure. Our control of it is very imperfect. But we have more control over mind than we have over anything else, except the voluntary muscles in the body and the essential mechanics of the body. Thank the Lord we have very little to say about, or we'd louse that up too. How would you like to have to manage your heartbeats or your respiration? There's some pretty good automatic machinery in there to take care of that.
Perfecting a human being, but boy, didn't they do a job.
They did a fine job. Anybody that designs equipment tells me that the designing technique used in the human body is simply tremendous. And what you're looking at is that you're looking at the product of a superhuman engineering department. These guys are just smarter than people. And we're getting pretty clever at design.
Did they also have the making up of the animal body?
I think it's a whole master pattern, Wilma, for a plant.
Somebody told me the other day that a Pekingese dog is the only dog that has, or the only animal that has a brain like a human.
I think mules are an awful lot like people.
Where
they're going to have out, it's going to have a mule show out here at the fair.
It's
going to
be a chariot race with mules.
Did
somebody see that picture of
the paper? I think when the life carriers set up the design, I think it's not an omniscient forecasting, but I think it is a real superhuman forecasting of the gene of the probabilities of gene reaction and gene permutation, the chromosomes and the chromomeres. And I think they've got... See, they've got something up there better than Univex. They've got seraphim. And when they say that the very hairs of your head are numbered of the seraphim, we're concerned about it effortlessly. These beings are mathematical prodigies. Well, suppose you've got a whole bank of seraphim hooked up in parallel or series, and you ask them questions about probability, you're going to get some statistical forecasting here that verges on precision. Now, what I don't think even the seraphim can cope with is the number of variables in the evolutionary process on an inhabited world. You got hurricanes, typhoons, tidal waves, you get this, that, and the other thing. I think they have pretty well charted the main line, but I don't think they can absolutely predict or foresee all of the byproducts. Or, to use a simple symbol, in designing the elevator, I don't think they always fully forecast the shape of the counterweight. Or, to take another example, in oogenesis, in the generation of the ovum in the female, you have an extrusion of polar bodies. The nucleus divides, the cytoplasm remains intact. Apart, half the nucleus is ejected. It's cast off in the process of this. Now, I think the life carriers pretty well plot the egg pattern, but they can't always forecast what's going to be cast off as a repercussion of this mainline. Are you with me? I think they get the action part forecast, but not always the repercussion part. I don't think life carriers designed dinosaurs.
That's just what I'm sitting here thinking.
I think they were very surprised when they showed up in the scheme of things.
Many others, too.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Is it an amoeba that
we
originally came from?
Well, and
it's
the one
that's put all this life pattern in that little thing.
And there's things before amoebas, too. We originally came out of the vegetative side.
Well, somewhere along the line, they planted
a brand new zygote would closely resemble an amoeba. A brand new fertilized human egg is a single-celled little animal. One nucleus, one cytoplasm. And that's what an amoeba is.
Well, there's sometimes when the embryo of the baby has a big tail,
the fear. I'll tell you, in the embryonic development, Wilma, think of a tree, which symbolizes evolution. The fish is out on a limb of that tree. At no time is a baby a fish. But if you will trace the development of a baby fish and a human baby, the parts that they have in common on the trunk before the fish branches off, yes, this part the baby goes through, along with the baby shark. But then pretty soon, as the fish splits off,
one way, the baby
keeps going up the limb. Now, the baby travels along farther with a chick, with a mammal. And the higher the mammal, the higher up on the tree it is before it branches off, so the more the baby has in common. The baby never has a fish tail, but the baby does have gills which open and close. A baby whale forms articulated legs and then disjoints them and embeds the residual bones in the body of the whale. A baby whale goes through a legged stage of development.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cut into a whale, you can find buried inside the body the disjointed bones of discarded legs in every whale.
These scientists must go crazy.
A whale has got hind legs, but they're on the inside of the whale. And they're not articulated anymore.
And of course, there are things in the ocean, yet that scientists have never seen.
This
they
is
say undoubtedly. Hawaii, you know, when those volcanoes erupt and the lava goes down to the sea, it brings up things that they've never seen. Never knew existed.
I think the life carriers plot the main line with considerable accuracy. I think they expected a pre-red type of human being here. But there's a little touch in here, such and such so many years back. The pre-placental mammals appeared and came to a speedy end. Didn't work. That was one that they, a long shot they played, and it didn't pan out. I think they planned Andaman and Sana, but I don't think they planned the dinosaurs. Makes an unreserved bestowal of all of his potential upon us. And it's just like it rains outside, you've got a barrel. You can catch your barrel full if it rains long enough. And the rest of it's going to fall on the ground. You're limited to your container. Thank the Lord, it's a growing container. Each jillion years, we're going to have that much more capacity to get what the adjuster's been trying to give us all along. I think we'll have two levels of consciousness, as finaliters even.
You do as
finaliters?
Mm-hmm. You don't think you'll ever?
I think the synchrony will grow and grow and grow, but I don't think it'll ever become complete. Because I think the adjuster has got eternal gifts to make to us, and it'll take eternity. But all the time we'll be receiving. I like that, JB, because it means that Christmas will never be over.
Well, it seems a little confusing to me. You make up your mind on one side, and it isn't made up on the other.
Oh, yes, I think it is. Sure. I think there's excellent synchrony, but I think there's more up there than you can tap. Oh, I think there's good synchrony.
You'll find a bigger
bag.
Yeah, tell me about that. Create a sign.
I'm not too sure. See if I can find this. I don't know where it is on the capacity to receive the gift. It's there. The adjuster give it to you right now. Wants you to have it now. And it only awaits our growth. And the minute we have the capacity, we have the gift.
In other words, you have to earn it.
The adjuster doesn't give you your long pants until you've outgrown your new britches. They're there. They're hanging on the rag.
I don't understand. What kind of different free will we have on the finite level that unfolds that we don't have now, and what kind of free will we're going to have on the abstract level that unfolds that we don't know anything about now?
Well, I'll simplify that for you, Bert. When I was on the Ebsonite level last... You scoundrel, I haven't any notion about that level. I think this, there's a statement which discusses the progressive freedom of man's will. I've forgotten where it is. I think it's in the first five papers. It goes on to say that when you become completely filial, then you can become completely free. Because when you really become a son of God, inherent in that is the fact that you have also become a brother of all of God's creatures. And then you can have freedom of choice. Yes. Because you're not going to hurt anyone.
Isn't this will on the two levels that Bert's talking about completely, but actually foreign to mind, since it stems from personality? And we're talking about mind.